Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning there, Marky.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well. We got a great email recently that I've wanted to read on the air for a little while, and now's the time. This is an email from Dan Greenhouse, and I have his permission to use his last name. Mark looks at me like, don't say the last name. I have his permission to use his last name.
I've been illegally rolling marijuana, and I'd like to know if
how I fix my grow
what
light.
What kind of herbicide I should be. I'm sorry, guys.
No. Dan Greenhouse writes, first, I love eating at your restaurant. By the way, anyone who wants to send me an email.
First, I love eating at
your restaurant. That's really a sentence that'll keep me reading for a little while at least. Second, I've converted my car to run on used cooking oil and would be happy to take yours for free. I live in Highland Park and can pick up the oil every weekend or whenever is appropriate for you. The best, cleanest way for me to do this is if you would be willing to place the fryer oil in the original 35-gallon plastic jugs it came in, or 35-pound plastic jugs it came in. For more info about my car and how I use the oil as fuel, see www.geocities.com/dgreenhouse2003, and we'll put that up on our website later. He's converted his car to run on used cooking oil, biodiesel.
I have a question for you.
What?
Is his last name really Greenhouse?
Yeah, isn't that great? Isn't that great? I love it.
I guess that forces you to a certain lifestyle.
I have one thing to say. Dan, good for you.
Yeah, that's great.
Sorry, can't have my oil. We converted to a system about a year ago that recaptures that oil for recycling.
For recycling, just for exactly that kind of a purpose.
And we never touch it. Just so you all know, most restaurants out there have a real and the reason we went to this system is because most restaurants, and we don't use very much fryer oil. I mean, the Italian restaurant doesn't use a lot, and the American restaurant uses very little. But most restaurants fry a lot of food. And you have your one or two fryers. Mm-hmm. And what you have to do is when you change the oil, and the best restaurants will change the oil more frequently.
I mean, if you're using your fryer oil a lot, you should be changing it at least every day.
Right. So what they do is they take that fryer oil, they put it back in the 35-pound huge plastic jugs, and now you've got this big thing of this waste fryer oil that you've got to have a company come and pick up.
And you've got a store in the interim. And frequently, and trust me, nothing makes more of a mess than spent fryer oil.
If you spill it.
That gets spilled.
Or the container gets nicked.
Or bursts. It's
all
awful.
Terrible.
It is the worst spill that a restaurant
And it's very hard. It used to be the companies would come and pick it up for free because they would recycle it and make a profit on that. Now it's hard to do that. Companies in New Brunswick, New Jersey, anyway, you need to pay to get them to pick it up. And they're notoriously terrible in coming. We were scheduling pickups, and they'd say, we'll be there on Tuesday.
Schedule a pickup 10 times and a company wouldn't come. I mean, just one of those things that in a restaurant you live with.
Well, and what people do with biodiesel is they convert their diesel automobiles, very little conversion, it costs a couple of $100, to run on either diesel or biodiesel.
It's really a cool idea. And biodiesel is
cooking oil.
Cooking oil.
And you can get and many restaurants in your neighborhood, if you say, hey, listen, can I take some of your used cooking oil? And you have a filter in your garage that will filter it out to make sure that it's, you know, you don't want French fries in your gas tank.
The person who owns this car is gonna obviously Dan has some kind of facility to fill some filtration system, because frequently, especially in restaurants where they're not taking very good care, there could be other materials in that oil.
But basically, you can get your fuel for just about nothing. I mean, there are plenty of restaurants willing to give this to get who are dying to get this out of their basement. And what he said is where he just moved to the area, but he came from a place where he had a relationship with a restaurant where he would regularly pick up their used oil. Mm-hmm. And think about it. You can go get your gas for free from a restaurant.
Well, plus the fact that that's really turning up the volume on reusing things in our planet.
You do smell a little like French fries, though.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, and I actually have yet to encounter a biodiesel car. But the word on the street is that they
cause you to smell a little bit like French
fries. Well, they cause the car, and like when you pull up, people are like, oh, I feel like burgers. I don't know why.
You know where I'm not going to pick up the used oil?
Where?
Long John Silver's.
Yeah. Because
what I don't want to smell like is a fish stick.
But as a restaurateur, I mean, I know we have a lot of people in the business out there. This can make some major savings for both your restaurant and your fuel supply.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and trucks can be made to run on biodiesel as well. And the thing about it is, if you don't have the fuel, and well, this is something that people have voiced concerns, if you don't have the fuel, you can just go and buy some cooking oil, which is about the same as buying diesel fuel
right.
if you run out. And so, you know, you don't need to necessarily find an all-night, you know,
Right now, cooking oil costs about, I think it's somewhere around $2, $3 a gallon, so... There you go.
Well, I think one of the reasons people are reticent about that, some of the people I've talked to, is like, well, what do you do if I don't have cooking oil? I can't stop and get cooking oil on the side of the road. But actually, you can, first of all. And secondly, most of these cars will also, you can switch back to taking, it will run on regular diesel if you don't have the cooking oil handy.
And the other thing is, you can store cooking oil in your car where you can't store gasoline in your car. So if you really have an issue, put a 5-gallon thing of cooking oil in the trunk of your car.
Anyway, so I would have done this if we hadn't switched over, what was it, a year and a half ago, to this recapturing tank system, I would have done it and supplied my own, and taken the spent grease from the restaurant and put it in my car.
It would have been a great system.
It would have been a terrific system, and I wouldn't have had to pay for gas anymore.
Yeah.
And also, biodiesel, when you burn it, doesn't produce the same kind of pollutants.
Mm-hmm.
That,
emissions we didn't even talk about.
That are produced, produce a little bit of a hamburger smell, but it doesn't produce things that are bad for the planet. Check out biodiesel, man, and if you want to go, again, we'll put this guy up on our website. It's www.geocities.com/dgreenhouse2003. Check restaurantguysradio.com. We'll link you there. And you can learn about how you can do this to your car, save yourself some money, do good for the planet, and take a little bit of a pain in the butt from a restaurateur's hands.
I think it's a really cool thing. And this guy's right in our backyard, too.
Yeah, really terrific. Sorry, can't have mine. Well, the one thing he did say was interesting. He said, I usually go for... Hold on a second. See if I can find this. I usually go for the high-end restaurants because they change their oil more frequently,
mm-hmm.
and you get fewer smells, and it's a higher quality of oil. Isn't that great? So even go to high-end restaurants, even to get your fuel, you want to go to the higher-end restaurants. Next item in the news, it seems as though movie theater owners, we bring this up because it's restaurant owners face similar choices. We've talked about this in many shows. Movie theater owners faced with falling attendance are considering asking federal authorities for permission to jam cell phone reception in an attempt to stop annoying conversations during films. And that's from the head of the industry's trade group. I don't know what's going on with consumers that they have to talk on phones in the middle of the theater, said John Fithian, president of the National Association of Theater Owners. Will actually petition the federal government, Federal Communications Commission, to remove the block on jamming cell phones, because you're not really allowed to jam cell phones anywhere.
See, you know what, though? This is just one of those common sense things. You know, if you're just going to chat on your cell phone in the middle of a theater, use your head, okay? All right, every once in a while a cell phone's going to go off because someone's forgotten to turn it off. I accept that.
Well, but also, parents going to go to the movies, and they want their cell phone in their pocket on vibrate in case something goes wrong with the babysitter.
Or forget about the babysitter, okay? I want my heart surgeon to be able to... Cell phones are a great thing. My heart surgeon can call me whenever there's an emergency. My heart surgeon can be reached.
Marcy's heart surgeon doesn't have to call you, Mark. You might want to call him, but...
Whatever. I'm able to call my heart surgeon whenever necessary. Don't do this and have a little chat in a theater so that we have to block cell phone calls in public places.
And the heart surgeon should get up and go out and take the call outside. Hey, when we come back, we're going to be talking with Terry Thies, who is one of the top importers of German and Austrian wines in the country, and he's a very interesting guy. We'll be talking with him in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Mark Francis and Catherine Lombardi at State Left Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Terry Thies. Terry's an importer of German and Austrian wines and also of estate bottled champagnes from small producers. Terry's been bringing in German and Austrian wines for a long time. We've known him for about 10 years, and we carry a lot of his product back from the time when he was singing alone in the valley, and not as many people were listening as they are today. German and Austrian wines today, a high-quality selection, have to be on any wine list that's serious in any way, and they've been in the New York Times recently, and if you don't know about German and Austrian wines, you're not cool. Hi, Terry.
Hey.
Welcome, hey, Terry. How are you? Welcome to the show.
I'm the coolest of the cool.
You are, man.
Well, so I'm the ur-cool.
You were the first one really singing from the mountaintops, Terry. Well, the second one.
Well, yeah, you haven't heard me sing.
There was that whole Hills Are Alive thing, and then, it was
exactly.
Well, now, German and Austrian wines have, in the last 15 years or so, really gone through a sea change of where they were not taken very seriously maybe 15 years ago, and maybe a wine list might have one or two sweet Rieslings on the wine list, and now, at least in the urban centers, it's like, that's the cool thing. German and Austrian wines seem to even be cooler, you know what I mean? What? How did that turn around, and what's the state of the American market for German and Austrian wines today?
Well, that's a gazillion questions all rolled up into one little ball, isn't it?
I'm a professional, man.
Yeah, I can tell. All right, let me see which one of your questions I'll answer
first. I was going to say, pick one you like and answer it.
Well, I think that the most difficult segment of that question to answer is how it happened. I mean, you could always try and draw a linear inference that it happened because my colleagues in the German wine industry and myself, you know, just pounded the pavement for so many years, and we finally got a certain number of people to sit up and take notice.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most pleasant sounding of the explanations. I think the other, and perhaps possibly truer explanation, is that these things just run in cycles. And a wave began to build under this category of wine at the same time that people began to experience what I like to call shard ennui, which was sort of the malaise of drinking that particular style of wine, which, whatever its virtues may be, they tend to pall after a fairly brief period of time because the wines are so emphatic and blatant. So there's really no way to be absolutely sure. I mean, I think the condition of the market right now is potentially very healthy indeed.
So was it a change in us, or is it a change in the wines, or some combination there?
It's a combination, and I think that it's more of a change in you than it is a change in the wines.
Well, let's deal with what changed in the wines, though, over the last 15 or 20 years, in German wines in particular. What's gone on that German wines today are being made in a different style than maybe they were 15, 20 years ago?
I'm not sure that I buy the notion that they're being made in a different style, but I would buy the notion that they're being overall made better.
Hmm.
What's going on in Germany is a thinning of the herd. Viticulture, at this point, is increasingly being confined to people who really believe in it, as opposed to, you know, kind of a lot of pretty ordinary farmer hacks who were making adequate wine and had a clientele for it. But now you've got, you know, the old cliche about people drinking less but drinking better.
Mm-hmm.
And that certainly is happening in Germany, along with the advent of a young generation that is just going, you know what, to the wall to make the highest possible quality. The other things that took place were the advent of a very active wine press in Germany and, of course, the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
So you have lightning-quick exchange of information, and you also have a wine press that's constantly doing comparative tastings trying to see who's best. So the ambitious young grower wants to show well in these competitive environments, and at least for that reason, among many others, he's going all out to make the highest possible quality.
Well, we have that here, though, in the United States, and what we have is kind of everybody trying to make the same style of wine. Is that what's going on in Germany?
Yes and no. I think that what you have is people trying to make pretty big, concentrated wines. They're being aided and abetted by global warming, and so the wines are much bigger now. Look, I just came away from tasting 2005s,
mm-hmm.
in which many wines will be bottled as cabinets, which in the 80s would have been sold as auslese.
We need to talk about what cabinet and auslese is, I guess.
All right, we can get to that. But in any case, you've got a lot of pretty outsized wine by German wine standards, and that has to do with warmer years, better viticulture, more selective harvesting, and again, producers seeking to outdo one another.
Well, let's talk for a moment. You touched on a point briefly that I think people would find interesting. Why does global warming tend to make bigger wines? I mean, can you explain to people the basic functionality of that?
Sure. The more ripe your grapes are, the more sugar they've got in them at the time you pick them. And when that sugar ferments into alcohol, you're going to have more alcohol, all things being equal.
Right. Well, every winemaker has a decision to make. And that is, do I take all my sugar and make it into alcohol, or do I leave some sugar and some alcohol?
Mm-hmm.
Well, and if you leave some sugar, that makes a sweeter wine. But overall, if you've got bigger grapes to begin with, if you've got warmer weather, you're going to have bigger wines. And so there's actually a number of people in a number of regions of the world are very concerned about the fact that the character of different wine regions are changing as all of their wine regions warm up. And how keenly is that being felt in Germany, which is on the edge of winemaking viability, of grape-growing viability?
In effect, Francis, you answered your own question. It's it is not being particularly keenly felt in Germany, because Germany really is on the fringes of possibility of viticulture. So in that sense, I think Germany is going to be the last country in which this phenomenon might be perceived. Austria, maybe a little bit less so. I mean, the Austrians for a long time in the late 80s really flirted with overstatement and overripeness, and they were really pushing the envelope and in some cases bottling wines with 15.5, 16% alcohol.
We're going to talk more about German and Austrian wines with Terry Thies, one of the country's top importers of German and Austrian wines, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi and Stage Left Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And our guest today is Terry Thies. Terry is one of the top importers of German and Austrian wines into the country and has been for many years. German and Austrian wines are receiving quite a bit of press attention and are really much more popular now than they ever have been, due in no small part to the efforts of Terry. But Terry, we were talking about how German wines became as popular as they are, especially in the top restaurants, especially in places with ambitions to be great wine destinations. And it was you and the people who beat the pavement, but there's a whole generation of sommeliers who are crazy about German wine and sort of spreading the religion and twisting people's arms to not get the Chardonnay and to try the Riesling. How did that come about, and who are these people?
Well, I think the big bang for that movement actually was Josh Wesson and David Rosengarten, who, when they published their late lamented wine and food companion newsletter, wrote a piece, somewhere right around 1990, saying that German Riesling was going to be the next big thing. And then you had the advent of this young generation of sommeliers who weren't as ossified and sort of stuck in their orthodoxies as the generation which preceded them was. And these people were drinking German wines, liking them, finding them food-friendly, and blissfully unaware that they were uncool wines. So they just went ahead and trusted their own palates and their own senses and said, yeah, we need to do more of these. And luckily, eventually, the world began to catch up with them.
So do you think it was the wines or the wine's ability to match with food? Do you think it was the flavor of the wines or the wine's ability to match with food? Or clearly, you think both?
Yeah, clearly, it was both.
Well, speaking
the wines innately taste good. That's something that people don't talk frequently enough about German wine, which is that they are, at the very least, simply delicious.
Well, and speaking as a sommelier at the time, I mean, the fashion for the new wines at the time was all these big, super powerful Chardonnays that were, you know, made in an oak barrel and aged in an oak box and served to you in a wooden goblet, you know. And these wines, while they got, you know, 100 points, when the sommelier, who was faced with the task of matching it with food, tried to do that, those wines don't go well with food.
And well, what they go best with is if you just eat the wooden goblet that they were served in.
You know, after the news, I want to talk about the Chardonnay Challenge.
Oh, yeah. We had a Chardonnay Challenge with Terry many years ago, and it sort of led to him converting us to his religion of Riesling and the like. We'll be back in just a moment after the news, talking with Terry Thies, one of the top importers of German and Austrian wines. And if you don't know about German and Austrian wines, you need to, so stay tuned and listen to the show. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is our friend Terry Feast. Terry is one of the top wine importers in the United States of America, of German and Austrian wines in particular. He's been importing these wines since before they were cool, and now they're really, really cool. He comes to talk to us today about German and Austrian wines and what you should be looking for out there when you go to your liquor store shelf.
So, Terry, before the news, we were talking about an event that we've held in Stage Left now two, three times called the Chardonnay Challenge, where we pair your wines from Germany and Austria against, and we match them with food, and we pour Chardonnay at the same time, and really good Chardonnay at the same time, side by side with the Riesling, and let our clientele decide which they like better. And it was kind of a fun little event for us. But I'm going to tell you, without fail, I would say between 80 and 85% of the people preferred the Rieslings to the Chardonnay.
How did that event come about?
Well, we used to call those events shootout at the Oaky Corral. It was basically just me, you know, wanting to take the battle to the wines that were the, you know, the sort of prevailing wines on white wine sections on wine lists at the time. And I knew very well that Rieslings were a far better bet, all things being equal, for most dishes in most upscale restaurants. And luckily there were enough chefs who were willing to let me demonstrate it. And we kept kind of ratcheting up the competition. And I never selected the Chardonnays. I always encouraged the restaurant to do that. The only thing I asked was that they be absolutely blue chip. And the thing reached its grotesque climax when I actually did an event in San Francisco at Bradley Ogden's restaurant. And the Chardonnay that was in the first course was that week's Wine Spectator. Spectator selection was 96 points.
Uh-huh.
And 90% of the audience preferred a German Riesling over that Chardonnay.
You know, what's interesting about these big oaky wines that we're sort of having tongue-in-cheek, and I like big wines sometimes, but they're very appealing on the face of it. But as you go, it's funny, as a maitre d', Mark and I, often will sell somebody a $200, $300 bottle of Chardonnay and wind up clearing the bottle with a glass or two left in it. Because
yeah.
They don't go super well with food, and you get tired of them sometimes. Well, Rieslings are quaffers.
Exactly. Well, they tend to be kind of rather narcissistic, sort of all-or-nothing wines.
Mm-hmm.
They're like really loud rock and roll. And sometimes there's definitely a time and a place for really loud rock and roll, and I enjoy it quite a bit. But it does tend to kind of shut the rest of the world out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what these kind of big heavy metal monster wines very often tend to do. They draw all your attention to themselves. They kind of push you down on the sofa and just say, okay, now you just watch me and I'm going to strut my stuff. They don't really encourage an interactive relationship between drinker and wine. They give you a lap dance.
Well, one of the reasons I think you've seen sommeliers move away from Chardonnay and into Rieslings and Grüneveltliner and certain other wines from the regions that you import, Terry, is that while Chardonnay can be a decent food wine, if you've picked it perfectly as a perfect match, that's more unusual than it is usual.
Exactly.
Well, you know, the other thing that was very interesting is that before Rieslings became written about in all the major papers as they are, they were for a while. If you went and hung out with, you know, the best sommeliers in New York and all the people who were doing this for a living, you know, Mark and I would go out in restaurant circles. We have a lot of friends in restaurant circles. The sommeliers who would, during the course of dinner, be very happy to sell you a $250 bottle of Marcus and Chardonnay. Themselves, we would drink. You know, there was sort of a disincentive to sell the great Riesling because a $250 bottle of dry wine Chardonnay, sure, there are plenty of them. But, you know, the Riesling of that same caliber is going to cost you $80.
Right.
And but you know, I think sommeliers have come around to realize that that's a great part of a meal, and you do better for yourself in the long run to recommend the wine that goes well with the food rather than go for the big sale.
Well, Terry, something that Francis just alluded to is that as far as bang for the buck, do you feel that there's a lot more bang for the buck if you spend $80 on a Chardonnay or $80 on a Riesling, will you be doing a lot better in Riesling?
Well, you know, I'm not a disinterested commentator.
Neither am I.
But I think there's absolutely no question.
Yeah.
Dollar for dollar, you're getting three or four times more quality in Riesling, European Rieslings, let's say, Alsace, Germany, Austria, than you are probably in any of the world, new world's big oaky monsters.
Mm-hmm. And actually, to the now, I was just leading you to this question. Do you think that's going to change?
There do seem to be signs of kind of an upward creep in prices. Some of them having to do with kind of arbitrary factors like a weak dollar. VAT is going to be going up in Germany next year. Production costs are rising. The wines are still the bargains that they always were relative to the prices of other wines in the world. That being said, however, they are more expensive than they were 5 years ago. But whereas 5 years ago a bottle of great German wine could be had for $20 and now maybe it has to be had for $30, that's still about the best $30 you can spend on a bottle of white wine. You're going to get more distinctiveness, more individuality, more flexibility back for that outlay of capital than you could, I think, with any other category of wine in the world. And this comes back to something y'all were just talking about, which is the difference between, you know, one of those kind of East German shot put bodybuilder type wines that kind of stands on the table, thumps its chest, and yowls at you, demanding your exclusive attention, versus another wine, like I like to refer to German wines as dance instructors, because even if you're clumsy, they are going to take you and glide you across the floor and make you feel as graceful and elegant as they are.
Don't think you've ever seen me dance, Terry.
I think the key is Mark needs a lot more German wine because I've seen him dance.
I think this is the beauty of German Riesling is that it can dance with people of varying skill levels and body types, if you catch my drift.
Well, Mark needs a double magnum.
There we go.
But, you know, one of the let's look at the other end of it. I hate to keep talking about price, but I mean, I think that when we compare wines relatively, you know, I see people spending a lot of money on California wines, and I love California wines. But when I recommend people, we used to have a retail shop, and I still sell some wine retail because I still have the license. On the other side of things, in all the consumer classes that I teach, I love to teach the class on German and Austrian wines. Because on the other side of things, when people want to buy wine to take home, in the $9 bottle range, let me tell you something. $9 bottle of Cabernet from California, buy something different. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But there are $9 Rieslings out there that are phenomenal.
Yes, there are.
And age-worthy.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about why these German wines, even the moderately priced bottles of German wine, are so age-worthy.
Shockingly age-worthy.
Yeah, it's true. And it's in the nature of Riesling. It has to do with Riesling's innate characteristics to have both high acidity, low pH, and all things being equal, residual sugar.
Mm-hmm.
When white wine ages, if it contains residual sugar, you know, the components of wines age at different speeds, but the one that ages the slowest is, in fact, the sweetness. And then we have to talk about the kind of the, you know, the naughty, the truth that dare not speak its name, which is sulfur dioxide.
Mm-hmm.
And if sulfur dioxide gives you a problem when you drink very young wines, then my advice to you is don't drink them very young.
Because it dissipates?
Yeah, it dissipates in a year or two. And then you'll have a wine that is basically it's guaranteed that it's going to not only keep beautifully, but also age beautifully if you can store it in reasonably good condition.
For people at home, I want to recommend, as I do in all my classes, that and buying a case of wine to age is much better than buying, you know, 12 different bottles of wine to age. Because,
right.
if you have the one bottle of 12 different things, you sort of, it's a crapshoot as to when you open it up and you say, wow, that was great, don't have any more, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Or I drank that too early, don't have any more, you know? So to buy a case of wine is something to age is an amazing thing. And you can, with a good Riesling of either very little sweetness or of great sweetness, put something down in your cellar that you can have for 5, 7, 10 years. And as restaurateurs out there, it's very hard now to go to a restaurant and find anything but the current vintage of everything because restaurateurs can't afford to sit on cases of wine for years. German wines you can, and I'm seeing that more.
And luckily, some German winemakers somehow could afford to do it because a lot of back vintage German wines have appeared on the marketplace, thanks to Terry and some of his producers and some other German winemakers as well.
We only have less than a minute left, but how old do these wines get? I mean, when the most age-worthy German wines, how far back have you gone, Terry?
Oh, my goodness, I've gone back deep into the 19th century. The oldest bottle of wine I've ever drunk was in 1862, Schloss Vollrads, which was drunk in 1985.
And it was still great.
It was. And 50-year-old cubiers and cabinets are not at all uncommon. And if you get them at the wineries, they're as pale in color and as fresh in constitution as a 3-year-old wine would be in the U.S.
We'll be back talking more with Terry Thies about wines that age better than we do just in a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardi at Stage Left Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, where we have an incredible German wine selection. We're talking today about German wines with one of the top importers of the country. Terry Thies joins us today to talk about German and Austrian wines that age better than we do. We were talking about how age-worthy these wines are, which is really remarkable, before the break. But actually, the age of vines, which makes a difference in wines, also comes into play. There are a lot of very old vines and vineyards in Germany. Am I correct?
You are. As a matter of fact, what very few people realize is the largest stand of so-called pre-phylloxera vines in Europe is actually in Germany, and there are, I don't know, 50 million individual vines that are planted on their own rootstock in the Mittelmosel.
And what that means is most vines in Europe are not planted on their own rootstock. After there was a phylloxera epidemic, which is a louse that attacked
plant louse and killed a lot of vines throughout the world.
And after that, in the latter part of the two centuries ago, the way that European vines generally battle that louse is to be planted on American rootstock. And
exactly.
So when you have grapes planted on their own rootstock, those are usually very old vines, and it's very unusual.
Yeah, I've got a producer in the Mosel who actually has 6,000 vines that were planted in 1896.
Wow.
From which, by the way, he can produce a very simple, everyday quaffing cabinet wine that can be purchased for well under $20.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you compare this to several New World parvenus whose names need not be divulged, in some instances who don't own a vine, have their wines custom crushed at some facility, they are several steps removed. They don't make the wine themselves. They hire a winemaker to do it, and they sell their first release for $125 a bottle, and you have to really wonder if the world has gone mad.
Yeah.
Well, they have to charge a lot for that money. They had to pay all those consultants.
They had to pay all those people.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Now, why do... Can you explain to our when we opened our wine shop, we called it Old Vines because
mm-hmm.
we love wines from old vines. Can you explain to people why the age of a vineyard or the age of vines has any relevance at all?
Yes, very briefly. The vine is a creature that needs water. And regardless of where you plant it, it will sink its roots as far down into the soil as necessary in order to find basically an aquifer. While it's doing that, of course, it's pulling up all kinds of trace minerals from any geological strata that it happens to pass through. The second thing is, the older a vine gets, the less it yields. And all things being equal, you have the same amount of energy going into producing less fruit, which translates into more flavor per grape.
Hmm.
So again, all
like
things
that.
Being equal, an old vineyard is going to give you more interesting and more concentrated wines than a young one will.
Interesting.
How deep can vines go?
Depends, of course, on the soil in which they're planted, but I was one of a team of 11 people helping to hack out a vineyard. We were pulling out 47-year-old Riesling vines. We stretched out the root system of one of these vines, and we paced it, and it was 113 feet long.
Wow. That's unbelievable. So let's talk just for a moment about sweet and dry.
Sure.
I think that a lot of Americans like to say, well, I want a dry wine,
mm-hmm.
because that's supposedly a delineation of quality.
Right.
Can you tell us how German Riesling kind of turns that on its head?
Well, first of all, there's a lot of people who simply know that the word dry is the proper word that they're supposed to use without really realizing what it signifies.
Yeah, I want to interject something, because sometimes when people say that tableside, they say, what's the driest wine you have? I like a very dry wine. And I'm so often tempted to say, no, you don't.
Exactly. Because you actually don't know at all what you like and don't like. Do you know how much sugar there is in Coca-Cola, Francis?
Well, they know what they like, they just don't know how to say it. And so dry is an easy word that people sort of throw out there to... But I know they don't mean it, so sometimes I try. So you were saying, I'm sorry, about dry and sweet in German wine.
Dry and sweet in German wine. Well, first of all, there's two things. There's the actual sweetness in a wine, which can be measured in the laboratory, and there is the impression of that sweetness on the palate. German wines usually comprise an amazing balancing act between acidity and sweetness. And drinking a well-made German wine is like eating a perfect, crisp, fresh fall apple. If that apple had no sweetness at all, it would be too tart. You'd spit it out. If it had no acidity at all, it would be so sweet that you wouldn't take a second bite. So when you have that balancing act between acidity and sweetness, the wines can actually carry what I call a stealth sweetness. It's kind of now you see it, now you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't register on the palate as sugariness.
Mm-hmm.
And even exalted quality levels of German wines, such as Auslese, which we can define presently, have less sweetness in a glass than does a glass of Coca-Cola. Very often, much less.
Oh, much less.
Much less. Coca-Cola has 116 grams per liter of residual sugar. Most German Auslese's have 70 to 90.
Mm-hmm. And the Auslese's are the sweeter, usually, of the German wines. There are many German wines that are made quite dry.
Exactly. There are many German wines that are made, in fact, completely dry, mm-hmm. absolutely bone dry.
Let's make a definition. What dry means is the absence of sugar.
Exactly.
The more sugar a wine has, the more sweet it is. Dry is the opposite of sweet. However, even dry wines can be fruity, which is the impression of fruit, which all good wines should have.
Right.
So what's with German dry wines? You've got a minute.
They're more and more fashionable inside of Germany. Properly, they should occupy an important minority of the production structure, let's say 15 to 20%. But the Germans have attacked them with dogmatic and ideological zeal.
Germans? Really?
Yeah, imagine that. And are trying to make them the fine edge of the V in their kind of international marketing, which makes no sense to me, because good though some of these wines are, it's like leading with your weakest suit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, the thing about great German wines is, and what I is, no matter what somebody says they wanted a dry wine or not, when you pour them a really great German wine to start their meal, everybody likes it. The serious wine enthusiast who's looking for subtlety and complexity and all sorts of stuff like that, and the person who just wants a great quaffable aperitif. It's really terrific. Hey, listen, we'll come back in just a moment and talk more with Terry Thies, one of the top importers of German wine in the country. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Catherine Lombardian Stage Luck Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Terry Thies. He's a top importer of German and Austrian wines, and we've been buying his wines forever. If you want to try these wines, we have them on our list at Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi.
You can also look in your local grocery stores or liquor stores, depending on where you live, and there'll be a strip on the back of the bottle that says Terry Thies Selections.
Terry Thies Estate Selections. We're going to link you to places where you can find great German wines. And we're going to explain to you a lot of the terms that we use today, Auslese, Baron Auslese, Cabinet. I'm going to put that all up on the website. So go to restaurantguysradio.com. You'll find out more about Terry Thies, and you'll find out a little bit more about these wines that we're talking about today. Terry, do you have any recommendations, some top places that people might want to look for, some names that they might go and ask their local wine merchant for?
Oh, there's so many good producers. I think that from Austria you could look for Nigel, for Brundlmeier, for Schloss Gobelsburg, for Heidi Schruck, for Hirsch. I think in my Champagne portfolio, Bilio, Gimonet, Geoffroy, among many others, Pierre Peters.
And if you don't know how to spell those will be up on our website as well. And how about from Germany?
Germany, Müller Quatuor, Willi Schaefer, Selbach Oster, Strub, Dönhoff, among, again, many, many others.
I have to tell you that our favorite producer is Selbach Oster.
Incredible wines. The Dönhoff is another one of my favorites, but Selbach Oster, definitely my favorite. Terry, we're not going to have enough time today, but we're going to have to invite you back another time. So you can start translating German wine labels for us.
Yeah. Why are they so hard to read, man?
Well, I'm not actually sure that they are so hard to read. I don't know that Zeltinger Schlossberg Riesling Spätlese is any more difficult than Pouligny Montrachet Clos de la Folatière.
Mm.
It's just that when you say the French words, you feel very urbane and seductive, and when you say the German words, you feel like Sergeant Schultz.
You do feel a little angry. I got to be honest with you. It's a more angry language. Hey, listen, we'll talk more about this. I do want to have you back on the show. Will you join us again?
Yes, I will.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you. Thanks so much.
You too.
Well, I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. German wines, I can't recommend them highly enough. We have great ones on our list. I have great ones in my cellar at home, and we're going to go to our website. We'll put up a lot of these producers in a lot of places where you can look.
And they will surprise you with how good they are with food. Rare red meat is pretty much the only thing you can't drink in German Riesling. Just about everything else.
For any time of the year. And I hope you've enjoyed the hour listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.